And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Visit DirecTV.com. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to The Athletic Support, your podcast on the Montreal Canadiens. I am Marc-Antoine Godin with Arpin Basu for the first time in 2021. Happy New Year, my friend.
Happy New Year, Marc-Antoine. It's been a year so far, let me tell you.
Yeah, yes, quite the year.
It's been quite the year.
Yes.
A whole year packed into 8 days.
But I know.
I mean, from the real life standpoint, and also obviously for our considerations, from a hockey standpoint, it's been a big week. Obviously, the Canadiens opened camp, and we have a lot of stuff to get to. So I think we should get
absolutely.
To it.
Absolutely. Let's get down to business right away. I think if we look at this year's roster, that there are many things that seem quite obvious, especially when it came to the first three lines on the Canadiens. But there are still some battles, some guys that are either fighting for spots or fighting for ice time. And I think that's really where it gets interesting. Salary cap considerations get in the way. The whole taxi squad thing, I think that we'll be able to discuss a little bit further. But I'd like to hear you first on... You know, you watched the scrimmage on Thursday, and there's a veteran called Paul Byron who really tried to make a point that, hey, guys, don't forget about me. And I know that there's a lot of people, and I think I could include myself in among them, who look at Byron and say, okay, that guy makes $3.4 million a year. He's going to be relegated to fourth line duties. Could he be one of those guys who could be like a salary cap victim in order for the Canadiens to really put their house in order? But by the way that he played yesterday, it really looks as though he wants to justify prove to the team that he still is relevant as he once was, and especially the day that he signed that contract.
Yeah, you know, I have a soft spot for Paul Byron, and it's funny, he begins, like, how many training camps has he begun slotted on the fourth line? And how long on average does it take him to move up the lineup? You know, usually in a normal season by like mid-November, he's playing a top nine or top six role. I mean, this is a guy with a chip on his shoulder. Like, this is really, Paul Byron is... I'm going to share this story, and I wrote about it last year, but I think it's worth getting into since you asked about Byron. So last season, we were in Detroit.
Lucky.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. That was a hell of a trip. That was the trip. That was the day Marco Scandella got traded. So actually, he got traded after the morning skate in Detroit, if I remember correctly. And at that morning skate, Paul Byron was returning to the lineup that night in Detroit, which obviously the Canadiens lost that game since they're playing Detroit. And so, but Byron that day sat down and after he was done with his scrum, I sat with him for like 10 minutes or so. And he like really, was really blunt and honest about how he had started the season, how ineffective he was at the time of his injury. And when he got hurt, he honestly thought to himself that, you know what, these guys aren't going to miss me much. I haven't been very good. He was on the fourth line at that point and was playing very poorly. Probably the worst hockey, like, in a Canadiens uniform that he's ever played.
Yeah.
And yeah. And he really took that to heart and really took, you know, what remained of that season, which, as it turns out, there wasn't a whole lot left in that season. We didn't know it at the time, but was really looking at the rest of that season as a chance to get back to his old self. And sure enough, within a couple of games, Paul Byron was back to his old self. He was playing a far more effective brand of hockey, was dangerous offensively, was getting breakaways, was scoring goals, was doing the stuff that Paul Byron normally does. Fast forward to the playoffs, I thought Paul Byron was a very effective player. I thought that line with Phil Deneau, Paul Byron, and Arturi Lehkonen in the playoffs was very good. And so, yes, he has that cap hit, which I think makes him easier to get through waivers. Now, if Paul Byron winds up on waivers at certain points to go to the taxi squad temporarily between games, I don't think people should freak out, because that's just cap management. I would be shocked. And because he's on right wing on that fourth line, I think a lot of people look at that spot, not only because of Byron's contract, but because Corey Perry is sitting right there, and Corey Perry plays right wing. Like, he doesn't play another position. So that looks like a spot where Perry could go in. But I think Byron knows that. You know, Byron looks at Corey Perry there, and he sees where he's lined up, and he knows that that's where Corey Perry would be if Corey Perry gets into the lineup. And I think Paul Byron has taken it upon himself again, as he has his entire career, to say, nuh-uh, this is my spot. And in that scrimmage and in training camp in general, I mean, he's been himself. He doesn't look a step slow, and he's just effective. He's being physical. He's being competitive, because he's fighting for his spot, and he knows it. He knows that he needs to defend his spot in the lineup. And he's doing that the way he always has. And frankly, at this point, we shouldn't expect anything different from this guy.
You know, I put myself in Marc Bergevin's shoes, and he's the one who decided to give him this long-term contract. And he always believed in Paul Byron. And if I put myself in a GM's shoes, he must think, okay, so there might be people around the league that will think that he's got negative value or zero value on the trade market because of his salary and because of the fact that he didn't have a good season last year. But when you look at it face value, you might say, okay, is there really something that has changed in his game that can make me believe that he cannot be the player that he was the day I gave him that contract? Because as you mentioned, the speed, which seemed to have declined at some point early last year and maybe at the end of the year, at the end of the season 2 years ago, by the end of the last season in the playoffs, it had come back.
Yeah.
And in training camp, he's got that jump, you know, that being that threat of picking an opponent's pocket and go on a breakaway. Well, actually, he scored a goal against Joel Edmondson precisely that way on Thursday. But that threat coming from his speed is back. And basically, there's not a whole lot in his game that has changed and really can convince you that he cannot be that 20-goal scorer or at least recapture some of the magic of the player that he was before. And when you mentioned that in the bubble, he formed an effective fourth line with Lehkonen and Danault, I think that planted the seeds of the fourth line that we see now. It might not involve Danault, but Jake Evans being like a poor man Danault and a younger
light
version.
Yeah, Danault
light. Danault light, you know, in the sense that he's got a timid arrival in the NHL, but at the same time, an unheralded, but still promises to become probably an effective two-way player down the road. And he's got those two guys that could make for a very potent defensive line that could take some of the responsibilities off the Tatar, Dano, and Gallagher line. So I think that's very interesting. But you need a guy like Byron to make that a defensive line. You put Perry in there, and all of a sudden, it's really a different complexion to that whole line. It changes the DNA altogether. So it's going to be interesting because it boils down to philosophy, to what you consider to be the priority and the main need for your team on that particular night to say, am I going with Byron? Am I going to Corey Perry? We haven't mentioned Michael Frolik yet. I think that he's another guy who's quite versatile. He had a terrible season last year, but he's a veteran who can play all three positions, well, mainly the two wings, but still, he's got that versatility that a little bit like Arturi Lehkonen's versatility. And the depth of the Canadians is all of a sudden so interesting. The only problem, you can't fit all those guys under the cap.
No, and there's a few things that I want to address before we move on, because I see a lot of things floating around that aren't maybe, that I don't feel are rooted in reality. First of all, regarding Paul Byron's cap hit and contract and what have you, the $3.4 million would not come off the cap if he got sent down to the taxi squad or if he got sent down. It's a limit of $1.075 million. So in that sense, Paul Byron is as difficult or represents as much of a savings on the cap if he's sent down as any other player who makes $1.075 million or more. So basically, everyone in the lineup except for Jake Evans and all the entry-level guys. That's one thing. Second thing is there's this notion that Corey Perry wouldn't make it through waivers if he was sent to the taxi squad, to which I would say, if he's such a lock to get picked up on waivers, why wasn't he signed until the Canadians signed him? And why was he only offered PTOs? You know, basically from what we've heard, the Canadians are the only team that really offered him a guaranteed contract. So everyone seems to take it for granted that there's no way Corey Perry will make it through waivers at $750,000. Well, no one else signed him at $750,000 until, what was it, 2 weeks ago or whatever it was. It hasn't been a long time. It hasn't even been 2 weeks. So this notion that there's no chance of Corey Perry making it through waivers when there's going to be tons of players put on waivers at the end of training camp just before the start of the season, as happens every single year, is also somewhat strange to me, because any team in the league could have had Corey Perry right up until the time the Canadians signed him, and no one was interested at that league minimum number. So now, I don't know why now all of a sudden his contract becomes very appealing when any team in the league could have given him that contract and chose not to. So, and same goes with Michael Frolik. So I think, you know, I think the cap gymnastics part of it, waivers is going to be this really interesting thing all season long, I think, because, you know, as soon as guys do make it through waivers, then you have the 10-30 rule come in where you can call the player back up from the taxi squad and he doesn't have to go back on waivers until he plays either 10 games or spends 30 days on the active roster, whichever comes first. And so you're going to see all these, that window is worth remembering this year, because that's going to be very relevant. And I think Paul Byron will wind up on waivers at some point to go to the taxi squad and to kick that window, to open that window where he can go back and forth and they could save that $1.075 million on a daily basis. And I think Corey Perry's going to wind up on there. And I think Frolik's going to wind up on there at some point. And there's going to be a lot of shuffling back and forth. But to the point of Byron, I mean, I think your point is totally valid. Like, you know, you mentioned Michael Frolik, like who comes out of the lineup for him?
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly.
Like who?
He's going to put, he'll play the day where there's going to be injuries in the lineup.
Yeah. And let me tell you, judging on what I've seen at training camp, he looks good in practice. Like he is a world-class taxi squad player. Like really good. So, you know, the Canadians are in good shape for what might happen in terms of the injuries. You know, God forbid COVID strikes the team. You know, they have a lot of bodies up front, at least. I think less so on defense. So that's where they're vulnerable a little bit. But forward-wise, you know, and we haven't even talked about, you know, like, you know, Jordan Wheel is there. And for all of Jordan Wheel's warts as a player, he's a guy who can play all three forward positions, can play on the power play if need be, is a decent offensive player. You could do worse.
He can win his face-offs on his strong side.
On his strong side. Like, you could do worse than having Jordan Wheel on your taxi squad. I think he's a really good taxi squad player. Like, that's a good guy to have there. So, Canes are in pretty good shape. I mean, all things considered, and I don't know how many teams are going to have it. If there was like a league championship where every team's taxi squad entered a tournament, I think the Canadians taxi squad would do pretty well.
Imagine, yeah, they should have an extra period of 3-on-3 and it's only involving Texas squad guys. It's like Canadians, the Texas Squad Cup.
Exactly. The Canadians could start engraving their name on it. You know, I think it would be they'd have a pretty solid chance, because you could conceivably have Victor Mete on there too, who's a legitimate NHL defenseman.
Yeah. So that's the thing. I mean, the Canadians right now, and I think when we spoke to Marc Bergevin, he was quite clear about that. The Canadians are not in a position to start the season with 23 men on their roster, even 22. So it's going to be either 20 or 21, with a lot of daily movements, depending if it's a game day or not, depending if where they might need an extra guy, whether it's going to be up front or on defense. But they're going to be basically faced with the decision, are we keeping one extra forward or are we keeping a seventh defenseman? And that's where, when you mentioned Victor Mete, I think that it's interesting because somehow his fate is connected to the one of Byron, Perry, and Frolik. Because if the Canadians decide to just stick with 12 forwards and send their extra forwards on the taxi squad to start the season, and they choose to keep a seventh D, well, then most probably Victor Mete is going to be that guy. But if they choose to keep only six, well, then he's going to be the one being put on the taxi squad, on first on the waivers and then on taxi squad. But I'm intrigued to know from your point of view if Mete, you know, up and coming defenseman in his fourth season in the league, making less than $1 million a year, is he more of a threat to be picked up on waivers than Corey Perry, for example?
Oh, for sure. I think absolutely for sure. And you know, and then the Canadians are also vulnerable in the sense that, you know, it seems pretty obvious at this point that Noah Juulsen is going to wind up on waivers to get to Laval. That's another possible loss on the waiver wire, just because he is an up and coming defenseman, obviously had a lot of injuries to deal with. And there's some technicalities there that might allow the Canadians to sneak him through waivers. But yeah, I think Mete is far more of a threat to be lost on waivers than Perry or Frolik or Byron, for that matter, or even, you know, I mean, it's, you know, Byron's contract makes him the most likely guy to get through waivers, frankly. But I mean, as I mentioned, you know, Perry and Frolik were sitting there available to every team. So I think both of them would get through too, unless some team suddenly has a significant injury to a player who's on their power play, then Corey Perry becomes attractive. You know, like if something happens between now and the start of the season where a team suddenly has a hole to fill that they didn't have before, that's where you could see a Perry get picked up, or even a Frolik. If someone loses like a, you know, a kind of a defensive forward who's on their penalty kill or what have you, then maybe that becomes more problematic. But otherwise, all things being equal, you know, the technicality I mentioned before is that when you pick a player up off waivers, I'm not going to get into all the details of it, but you have some obligation to keep him on your roster. You know, you can't really send him down to your taxi squad. So they need...
Well, you'll have to put the guy back on waivers.
You'll have to put the guy back on waivers to do that. Exactly. And there's all sorts of rules that I'm not going to get into. But anyhow, most teams, when you pick a guy up off waivers, basically you more or less have to keep him on your roster. So you have to have room for him in your lineup and room for him on your cap. And so Mete's a guy that where I could see there a team, several teams look at him and say, well, I could use him on my bottom pair. He's a good skater. He's a good puck mover. You know, gets play moving the right way. Has played a lot of difficult minutes in his career. Is very young. Is very cheap. That's a guy I could see where teams would say, okay, Victor Mete, I could take him and plop him on my third pair. Whereas I think in Perry's case, in Frolik's case, and in Byron's case, for different reasons, I don't know if that's necessarily going to be the case.
Yeah, I think there's a risk with Mete, and there's definitely also a risk with Noah Juulsen, who in my view might, you know, there's more of a question mark for health reason, but at the same time, I see his potential still his ceiling remaining higher than Mete's at this point in their respective careers. And it might be complicated for Canadian teams to pick up a guy on waiver from the US, but among Canadian teams themselves, you look at Ottawa or Winnipeg, they could both use some help on defense. And
yeah,
I could certainly see one of those two teams taking a flyer on one of those two guys and plugging them in their lineup as a third pairing guy. So it's going to be interesting to see. The Canadians will be faced with some interesting decisions, but on the blue line, what seems rather clear to me, and Claude Julien took exception of it, because at the beginning of camp, at some point during a media availability, I hinted to the fact that I use the expression inside track when it came to Brett Kulak having the inside track versus Victor Mete. And he says, oh, no, there's no inside track. But
yeah,
since then, I mean, it's pretty clear that he's the one being given all the chances in the world to, you know, to cement his place as a regular on the third pairing with Alexander Romanov, whether it be on the left side or the right side, that still needs to be determined. And it's interesting to see that Romanov proves to be comfortable on both sides.
He hasn't proven that. He's played in camp on both sides, but he has not proven to be comfortable on both sides, because he has played on the right side very minimally in his life. It's been overblown how often he's played on the right side. He really hasn't played.
You mean Romanov?
Romanov, yes.
Yeah. I know, but I mean, right now he's being tested. Okay, yeah, I'll rephrase it. He's being used on both sides at camp.
Yeah.
But I think that it's interesting to see that Kulak is the one having the upper hand right now. I don't know if we're going to see, you know, a recalibration of that in the second half of the of camp, and if Mete is going to be given more of a chance. But right now, you look at the power play with Romanov being at the point on the second unit, and Kulak, you know that if he's on his game, not only can he play in the third pairing, but he might even be a better alternative than Joel Edmondson next to Jeff Petrie down the road on that second pairing. So yeah, it's we had foreseen a battle between Mete and Kulak, but so far it seems to be pretty much going one way.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Well, this is what I find interesting about this training camp, is that we entered with all these questions. You know, you and I did this huge preview where we, you know, line combinations were a question. Who's Toffoli going to play with? Who's Anderson going to play with? Where does Kulak fit in? Where does Mete fit in? How do you use Romanov? All these questions. However, from day one of camp, nothing has changed. Very little has changed, I should say. Not absolutely nothing, but, you know, all four of the top lines have remained the same. The fifth line even has remained the same. The only difference being that Jordan Wheel came out when Corey Perry was allowed to join camp. The defense pairings have more or less stayed the same. The only difference being that Kulak started day one on the right side. Clearly the Canadians did not like what they saw that day, because Romanov has been on the right ever since. And they're trying to get a look at see if that's conceivable for him to start his NHL career on his offside, which I don't think is the best idea, but anyhow. And so everything's been cemented. And I think the biggest tell in terms of who's going to be in the lineup is you got to look at special teams roles. You know, like, I mean, the fact that Corey Perry is rotating in with Josh Anderson on the power play. I think, you know, when he was acquired and the way people are talking, like he was clearly acquired to help the power play. I think that's the main reason why he was brought in, as on top of the experience and the cup pedigree and everything else. He remains a very, very effective net front player on the power play. Yet, despite that, he has not taken the first team reps on the power play. He's the second rotation guy in there, which would lead you to believe that perhaps he's gonna, it's gonna take some time before he works his way there. And then you look at the penalty kill, and we haven't actually seen the Canadians' penalty kill units as such. I mean, they killed some penalties in the in that scrimmage, but that didn't really say a whole lot. But that's where, you know, that's where Paul Byron is extremely useful. That's, you know, and Lekkonen, you know, that they are on the top two waves of forwards going out. It remains to be seen who would be playing with Byron, but Dano Lekkonen is a lock as the top penalty kill unit. And then it could be Byron Armia, could be Byron Suzuki. Anderson could be in the mix, but in any case, whoever's the other forward there, Byron's one of them. So that gives him an, you know, to use your term that Julien took exception with, the inside track on a lineup spot. And that's really how I think you got to look at things, is that, you know, and Mete being essentially taken off the power play, because on Wednesday is the day that they did the first extensive power play practice. You know, I think they, yeah, they did it for a few minutes on Tuesday, but really on Wednesday, they spent a good half hour on it. And even went to the trouble to go to the second ice surface in Brossard to work on it. And Mete didn't go. And Claude Julien kind of wrote it off like, oh, we know what Mete can do. We wanted to see what Romanov could do. That's you and I can, we'll both, I think you and I will agree that that's garbage, in the sense that,
yeah, like it's, we know what Thomas Tatar can do on the power play, exactly, but they're going to keep him there.
Yeah, you know, like, oh, I know what Nick Suzuki can do, so why does he have to practice the power play since he's so good? Like, Victor Mete's so good at the power play, he doesn't need to practice even. We don't even need to see what he can do. So you know, him not being there was a pretty clear indication that they see Romanov anchoring that second power play unit, which is pretty extraordinary. I don't think,
yes,
anyone could have expected that right off the bat. And frankly, in that practice session and particularly in that scrimmage, he looks good on that power play unit. He has all the skills you would want out of a defenseman. His mobility, I want to say, comes as advertised, but it's even more than advertised. Like, honestly, like, he is right now, he is the Canadian's second best skating defenseman. On the blue, I'd put him ahead of Victor Mete in terms of his skating ability right now. I think the old,
oh yeah,
his footwork is okay. One example from the scrimmage the other day. At one point Romanov got caught. He got caught. He was a little too high in the defensive zone, and he did not anticipate Jake Evans' speed. And let me just add an aside: Jake Evans looks very quick in camp. He looks quicker to me. Like, he has added an element of speed to his game because he's fast all of a sudden. So he catches Romanov a little bit off guard and has him. And it looks like Evans is going to easily turn the corner on him and basically turnstile him. Romanov starts doing backwards cross cut something. He was doing, I can't even describe it, but like, his feet were moving so quickly that he got to that edge before Evans did, even though Evans had a step on him, and even though Evans was skating forwards and Romanov was skating backwards. But Evans never turned that corner. And it was striking to watch. Like, it looked like he got caught, and he did, and it looked like he was in a really bad position, but nothing came of that play. Evans wound up having to curl back and wound up in the corner and wound up sending the puck back up to the point, and they got an offensive zone possession out of it. So he got a zone entry, but he didn't get a clear path to the net like it looked like he was going to. And that was because of Romanov's footwork and his skating. So
he killed a play.
I mean, not in the traditional sense. And frankly, he shouldn't have put himself in that position to begin with. Like, that was a mistake. Yeah. But what's important here is he erased the mistake, and he erased the mistake with his skating and his footwork. So, you know, he is, to me, to my eyes, you know, after Jeff Petrie's, you know, the best skating defenseman on the Canadiens, he's second best. And so,
yeah,
for
the power play, I mean, his ability to you know, to dance down the blue line, and his lateral move is going to be super efficient and important for the Canadiens, and also his shot. I mean, he's got a great slap shot, and that second wave of the power play, clearly they want to focus on shot volume and say, well, you guys are going to just pepper the net with Tatar, with Gallagher, and also with Kotkaniemi. I mean, Jake Allen mentioned how he was impressed with Kotkaniemi's wrister.
Yeah.
And even though that
called it a missile.
A missile.
That kid's got a missile of a wrister. Yeah, it was pretty.
Yeah. That's it was pretty good.
It was a pretty good endorsement. Yeah.
Yeah. So having Kotkaniemi on that right half wall, even though he's going to be in the position, I think, to dish the puck a lot because he's going to be one of the most deft passer on that unit, he's going to be asked to shoot more and use that shot a lot more than he did in his first two seasons. But you add Romanov there at the point, all of a sudden you can clearly see the logic of having a big guy like Anderson or Perry in front of the net, where you're going to have tons of second chances, screens, deflections, you know, based on the fact that those guys can all shoot the puck quite well. So you mentioned Allen's endorsement on Kotkaniemi, but the team's endorsement on Romanov to put him there in his very first week of practice in North America.
Yeah.
I mean, it's fascinating. And once again, it's been a theme. You wrote about it before on The Athletic, but the level of trust and confidence that this organization has shown in Romanov is almost unheard of, because it's always about, you know, showing what you're worth, proving that you're that you belong. Nothing's going to be given to you, but in Romanov's case, the assumption and the prejudice, the positive prejudice against that player is so, you know, it's so uncommon that, I mean, it just tells you how confident they are that this guy is going to be ready for the show as soon as this season.
Yes. It's really remarkable. And what's even more remarkable is that he does not, it's so obvious he's an NHL player in camp. Like in no way, shape or form do you look at Romanov and say, oh, well, he's obviously the rookie here. You know, which is usually the case with rookies. You go into an NHL training camp, their first NHL training camp, and it's immediately clear who the rookie is, because they make mistakes, they're a little tentative, they're hitting people. You know, they stand out usually. He does not. He does in the sense that he skates really well and he's moving quickly and he's involved in the play and he's making you take notice of him. But he doesn't stand out because he's a rookie. If anything, he stands out because he fits in so well, you know, because he looks like an NHL. But if you may, first of all, I'd like to talk about that second power play unit because I find it really interesting. I just want to explain to our listeners the dynamic at training camp. Only one of us is allowed to attend training camp at any one time. Every media outlet is allowed one representative. So Marc-Antoine went to the first 2 days of camp. I went to the second 2 days, and we're going to be rotating kind of here till the end. But, you know, so I was the one who was there on the day they were practicing, you know, set plays on the power play. They were doing set plays off of faceoffs, you know, breakouts. They were doing all that sort of tactical stuff that they would have asked each unit to do. They did that on Wednesday. And so that second power play unit, to me, there's a few things that stand out that I just want to point out. First of all, yes, Kotkaniemi is the best passer on that unit, which also includes Anderson / Perry, Gallagher in the bumper, Tatar in the left circle, and Romanov up top. Kotkaniemi would assume be the designated disher on that unit. However, all the set plays that they were doing on Wednesday, especially off of faceoffs, but all the offensive zone work seemed to me to be geared to Kotkaniemi shooting, which I found really interesting. Like, he was not handling the puck that much. It was going around and they were trying to set him up for shot. At one point, Perry was in front and got the puck like at the side of the net and did a backhand pass to the circle for Kotkaniemi to one time it in. And I was like, that's interesting to me. Like, that's clearly something they worked on in the room before coming out. And it was one play after the other, after the other, after the other. So that's one thing about that unit. The second thing about that unit, Brendan Gallagher in the bumper. you know, you wrote about this and you spoke to his shooting coach, Tim Turk, who's been Gallagher's been working with for years and has frankly done wonders with Gallagher's shot since he entered the NHL. It's become gone from a weakness to a strength at this point. And so the assumption of a player in the bumper position is that you want him to be there as a shooter, which is what Toffoli will do on the other unit in that position. And I'm sure Gallagher will do that as well. But what I find interesting about Gallagher being in the bumper is, and I made this comparison to you as we were chatting on Slack, but with a guy like Anderson or Perry as the net front and the amount of attention that they will draw from opposing penalty killers, having Gallagher in the bumper and allowing him to come in as a second wave rebounder, if you will, to use a basketball term, kind of, I think is going to be really effective because Gallagher has this like Dennis Rodman like knack for knowing where rebounds will go. He has an innate ability to get to an area in front of the net at the right time when a rebound shows up there. So having him in the bumper, I think, will allow him to, and especially with the combination of having him in the bumper and having Anderson or Perry in front of the net, will allow him to do that. It'll be harder for defenders to box him out because he's coming from further away.
Right.
So I think that'll be effective. And second, and the third point I want to make, and then I'll stop talking, is you know, zone entries have been an issue. You've done it. You did extensive work on how bad the zone entries have been for the Canadiens power play for a long time. And I think it's going to be tough, even though, again, we're pumping his tires a fair bit, but Romanov looks really effective in this area so far. But the one thing about that second unit, and it happened in the scrimmage, and I noted it in my piece as an aside, but you know, having Josh Anderson and Brendan Gallagher as puck retrievers, with the speed that Josh Anderson has shown at training camp, which I don't think we've mentioned, the guy is fast.
Like, my God.
He is fast. A big, fast man. So having the two of them as puck retrievers for dump-ins is a real strength on that second unit. First unit, I'm not quite sure how they're going to get the puck in the zone. It's still iffy. Petrie's good at it. Suzuki's good at it. We'll see. But that second unit has that as an option, which is really – I'm eager to see how that works out because you know, poor Lucas Vedemo in that scrimmage, puck got dumped in. He goes behind the net to get it. For some reason, it was him and not a defenseman, but he finds himself there. All of a sudden, he has Josh Anderson and Brendan Gallagher on him, and – you know, half a second later, the Canadiens were set up on their power play, you know, and I understand Lucas Vedemo's an AHL player, a fringe NHLer, I think, at this point. But still, conceptually, I it's not hard to imagine Anderson and Gallagher being highly effective in that specific role on the power play.
No, well, I think that there's nothing wrong with chipping the puck and doing, you know, dumping it and going after it, doing dump and chase on the power play if that's the you know, if that's the play that's presented to you. Last season, when the Canadiens did that, used that strategy, according to Sports Logic numbers, they were one of the more effective teams using that strategy. Of course, you know, there's always, you're always better off entering the zone in control. But if you have to resort to, you know, putting the puck deep in the zone, if you have guys like Anderson and Gallagher coming in two waves to and a one-man advantage to pick up that puck, I think that it puts the Canadiens in a great position. And when you mentioned the fact that Gallagher could come also in second wave as for rebounds, then it makes it even more sense to have a guy like Kotkaniemi trying to shoot the puck, because then you've got two guys that are, you can potentially get on that puck for a second chance. So whether it be Kotkaniemi or Tatar, who's been very effective on the left circle last season, one of the few guys that really were true power play threats on that team last year, well, then you give yourself options. So it's also something that I mentioned in my article on the power play this week, is that a guy like Kotkaniemi, for example, the fact that he's a left-handed shooter and he's positioned on the right side, he could position his body in a way that it would look as though he would pass to Gallagher in the bumper, like in the center slot, and yet decide to shoot anyway.
Yeah.
So he could, which is something that just by body positioning, stick positioning, a right-handed guy could not do, because he would have to choose which one of the two he's going to do. But since the play is more open for a left-handed shooter in that situation, he could manage to fool goaltenders, especially with that wrist shot that we talked about earlier. So it's going to be interesting to see. It's going to be interesting to see which one of those two units is going to take off first. Different setups, different mindset. Also, I think that the first unit they want guys to make plays. That's the term that Kirk Muller likes to use. With Jonathan Drouin at the goal line, with Suzuki also at the circle, they're going to move the puck a whole lot. And I think that the priority here is to make sure that you don't stay outside the box. You don't stay. You want to stay inside the slot, and also, please, by dear God, create new threats that are not named Shea Weber.
Yes.
If you manage to create new threats and depend less on Weber, well, then Weber is going to become more of a threat himself. Yeah. So it's like the Jedi. You know, once the Jedi dies, he becomes even more powerful. Well, that it's the same with Weber. Yeah. You have to make the threat that he represents die, and then it is going to be
Shea Weber is Obi-Wan Kenobi.
That's it.
Strike me down, I'll become more powerful than you can ever imagine. That's exactly it. Shea Weber.
That's it.
But also, yeah, what I found interesting, just quickly on the first power play unit, is their ability to switch spots. You know, Drouin's on the goal line, Suzuki's in the circle. Those two are interchangeable. Suzuki mentioned even Toffoli could become interchangeable, and those three of them could switch spots. And so movement, cross-ice passes, I think you're going to, like when Muller mentions make plays, I think that's what he's talking about, in the sense that, you know, he wants quick passing. They want to create high-level opportunities and high danger chances, whereas I think on the second unit, they're more willing to create, you know, somewhat medium danger chances in an effort to create rebounds, get pucks to the net, crash and bang, and try and score that way. Whereas I think the first unit, they'd rather have some goals that'll wind up on the highlight reel as opposed to the second unit.
Yeah, that's a good comparison. We'll be it's anything. They have to find ways to make it work. There's no two ways about it. I think that the Canadiens have a winning formula 5-on-5. I think that they've helped themselves by adding Jake Allen as Carey Price's backup. I think that the goalie position is taken care of, but it's really the special teams. And you know, they'll be facing the Edmonton Oilers 9 times this year, 9 times, and and the Oilers are completely built. They're completely different than the Canadiens. They're built specifically out of special teams, both power play and PK. If you want to build, if you want to, you know, win against a team like that, you've got to be at least have your special teams straightened out. And it's been an anchor for the Canadiens at least the last 2 years. But I mean, it's been more than 10 years since they've had an 18% or more power play. So it's difficult.
Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business, take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. Shopify.com/theathletic. As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Let's move on. Arpan, I wanted to discuss two things with you. First of all, the World Juniors have finished. Obviously, the USA caught Canada by surprise. Canada seemed to wake up a bit too late in that that gold medal game. Overall, the Canadians had two main prospects there in Gouley and Caulfield. I'd like to have your assessment on both of those players in their tournament.
Is this where we get to freak out about Cole Caulfield like everyone else is? Because that's clearly that's clearly what's going on right now.
Yes.
You know, I think it's fair to a certain extent in the sense that this is his second year at the World Juniors. Generally speaking, you would expect him to have a bigger impact, wearing a letter on his jersey, who's an important player for the team. But again, usage became a bit of a thing for him. I think in last year's tournament, he was stuck on a fourth line. He wasn't really put in a position to do what he does best. And, you know, you wrote about Caulfield ahead of the tournament, how he was looking forward to going back to sort of his MO, which was to get lost and to be set up for shots and to be more of a scorer. But I found on his line with Matt Boldy and Matty Beniers, who, man, what a prospect Matty Beniers is. I loved watching that kid play. But anyhow, I found that Caulfield was still kind of the primary playmaker on that line. You know, he was the guy looking to make passes, looking to set guys up, and he got his chances and he got a lot of shots off. And yes, in an ideal world, you would have liked, you know, a few of those posts to be goals. But I don't think he was put in a position to do what he hoped he would be able to do, which was to get lost in the offensive zone and to have a playmaker like a Trevor Zegras, for example, or you know, even a Turcotte. But really, I would have liked to have seen him with Trevor Zegras to see what might have happened there. But again, you know, I mean, you have to perform in the role that you're put in within the concept of the team. And I thought he played well. I don't think he didn't play poorly. Yes, the numbers aren't there, but I would be encouraged to see that he has a more well-rounded game. He's not a liability defensively anymore. It's never going to be a strength of his game, but it's something that he pays more attention to and that he focuses on a little bit more. He backchecks with more regularity and with more enthusiasm. As I mentioned, his passing has improved.
He's an underrated passer.
It's improved a great deal. I mean, I think he's been underrated because he never had to pass before. You know, like no. When you play with Jack Hughes, a good idea is to give Jack Hughes the puck and then go get open, which is what Cole Caulfield's good at, is getting open. So, you know, I think his passing has been underappreciated and probably underexposed because he really hasn't really been put in a position to do it. But we've seen it at Wisconsin. that how much his passing has improved. And I think we saw it at the World Juniors as well. But the numbers weren't there. And that's just, that's a fact, you know? And so I think some of the panic, you know, if I can call it that, but some of the outcry, I guess, from Canadians fans that I've seen is justified in the sense that, yeah, you would have hoped in his second year, you know, like Turcotte did, like Zegras did, even like Matt Boldy did, you know, in when you're 19 years old, you're expected to produce at the World Juniors, and he didn't produce quite at the level that you would have hoped. So I think that's justified. But to say that he played poorly in the tournament, I don't think that's very accurate.
Yeah. I think one thing that's clear to me is that if you're a shooter, if you're a goal scorer, and you got a gift like Cole Caulfield has, it might help him reach the NHL. And I think that the way that, you know, both his shot and his ability to get lost and find like open pockets is something that's transferable, adaptable to the NHL. I'm not too concerned with that aspect of his game. But the other aspects, the more quote unquote boring aspects of the game, whereas like, you know, the play without the puck, you know, being responsible on 200 feet, all that sort of stuff that I think that he showcased to a certain extent during that tournament is what is going to enable him to earn the trust of his coach in the NHL to go out there in the first place and put himself in a position to score those goals.
Yeah.
So it's one thing to say, okay, well, he's able to score. But if he doesn't, if the rest of his game doesn't earn his coach's trust, he's not going to get the minutes that you would be looking for. So, yeah, I agree. I think that to a certain extent, it's a disappointment that among his peers, he did not find a way to produce more than he did. But I think that his tools remain the same and they're not lost. But what that tournament and frankly, the beginning of his season in Wisconsin, I watched pretty much all of his games to, you know, to really identify what his game has turned into. And he's being a more responsible player is going to be key to reach the NHL and get that, you know, that regular spot. Now, is he going to be a 40 goal scorer, top six forward and whatnot? Frankly, I don't think so, but he could very well be a guy that, you know, for example, you put on your third line, you put on your first power play, and he could be able to manage to reach 30 goal just by being that elite power play producer. Again, you talk about usage with the United States. He was used in a bumper, whereas clearly he's a guy who's more effective in the circles rather than right in the middle of the slot.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that there's another factor there. I think that you would put him with the Canadians on either circle, left or right. I think that he would make that power play better. And I think that's what's going to happen, maybe at least as soon as next season. Heck, we could see him for a few games at the end of this year. But
that was one of my bold predictions, that he will play at least one game with the Canadians this year.
Yeah, well, that's it. So I think that you know, all hope is not lost for him. His skating has improved, his passing has improved, his defensive awareness has improved. And when you've got a scoring touch like he does, you can stay unlucky only for so long.
Yeah.
So, but that being said, and if it could be a good segue into the next item that I want to discuss, which is Pierre-Luc Dubois. I think that Cole Caulfield remains or seems to me like a guy who could be a trading chip for the Montreal Canadiens if there's an opportunity that rises on the market for a star player. And well, with all due respect to Caden Gooley, I think that he had a decent tournament and made things quite satisfying for Canadiens brass. If we move on directly to Pierre-Luc Dubois, because I'm eager to hear you about it. Here's a star player, local star player, who likely will become available. I'm sure that the Canadiens will be all over this guy. Perhaps not during the season, but certainly after the season, if there is no trade that's being done before that. How much of a fit do you see Dubois with the Canadiens? And what do you think the Canadiens will need to give up in order to acquire him?
Well, listen, if I'm Jarmo Kekäläinen, the conversation starts with Nick Suzuki. Like that's the starting point. And it's a legitimate ask. You know, Pierre-Luc Dubois is a tremendous young player, big, strong, talented. You know, he checks all the boxes. Obviously, he's a kid from Quebec, and you know, there's the added box that the Canadians have that most other teams don't. He checks that one as well. So the ask, if I'm Jarmo Kekalainen, is Nick Suzuki, just right off the bat. Then you have to ask yourself, okay, well, Nick Suzuki's already got like a 40-point season in an abbreviated season, led the team in scoring in the playoffs. Is it inconceivable that Nick Suzuki is going to be a more productive player than Pierre-Luc Dubois? I don't think it's inconceivable. It's very possible. Pierre-Luc Dubois, you know, he's so far been someone who gets, you know, roughly 50 points a year, somewhere in that neighborhood. Nick Suzuki's almost there already. And so let's say Bergevin says no to that. Let's just say, because it wouldn't only be Nick Suzuki. It would be Nick Suzuki plus probably a pick and a prospect of some sort. So then Jarmo Kekalainen moves on to Jesperi Kotkaniemi. And like, let's be clear, Pierre-Luc Dubois is a 22-year-old player, you know, 6'3", 220 or so. He's a proven producer. Sorry, he hit 61 points in his second season. So, you know, 27 goals. He's a productive player. So you want someone who projects to be something like that. And the Canadians happen to have two guys who are in that realm in the sense of Nick Suzuki and Jesperi Kotkaniemi. So if Kekalainen moves on from Suzuki and says, okay, then I want Kotkaniemi, number 3 overall pick, Pierre-Luc Dubois, number 3 overall pick. Seems like a fair deal. Since Kotkaniemi hasn't proven himself to the same extent, maybe Bergevin would have to add something. But the question I would ask you, because I think I know what my answer would be to this, but Kotkaniemi is now 20 years old, which still I think people tend to forget. You know, he'll be 21 in July after the season. Dubois will turn 23 about 2 weeks before Kotkaniemi turns 21. So they're 2 years apart. 2 years from now, is it likely to you that Kotkaniemi would be a better player than Dubois is right now?
Likely no, but certainly possible.
Yeah.
You know, it's not out of the question. And what's interesting to me is that, you know, trades are going to be very difficult to accomplish during the season. I don't know if it's even going to be worth having a trade deadline special on TSN this season. So are the Blue Jackets going to move Dubois during the season or after the season? If they choose to do it after the season, well, a lot can change in the assessment of the young centerman in Montreal during that next season. And if Kotkaniemi continues on the trend that he has shown in the bubble and establishes himself like at least as a second line centerman, but as a guy who could trend towards being a 60-point guy or even more, as he matures physically, as he trusts that shot more and more, it's certainly possible that 2 years down the road, Dubois and Kotkaniemi could become, you know, comparable players. It's the difference is only that because you got one guy who's older and he's shown it to you, well, there's more of a certainty than the guy who could become, and then there's a question mark and all that. And there's, but with that question mark comes also, a financial aspect to it. It's just younger players make less money, and if the Canadians were to acquire Pierre-Luc Dubois after the season, it would be only 1 year away from earning another big contract. And now the Canadians, if they give up a lot, would have to be ready to really, you know, bring the dough to have him signed. And all of a sudden you say, okay, well, how would that fit to have a guy on our team? Do we have even the cap space to have a star centerman that we would pay $8 million or $9 million a year?
Yeah.
And that's where, you know, that it's useful for the Canadians right now to have Kotkaniemi and Suzuki. Kotkaniemi, his contract will be up after this season, but Suzuki will have another year. And it's useful to them to have that that flexibility, because otherwise, you know, their hands would be tied up. If they had to pay them today the sort of money that would be comparable to, equivalent to the players that they could become, they would be in a very difficult spot. Well, so now it's interesting for them, that fact that they can have Suzuki and Kotkaniemi on the cheap. But with Dubois, it's all of a sudden, you know, it becomes a puzzle.
Well, Dubois' contract actually is very interesting to me, and there's a couple more. I think, you know, I'll be interested to see what happens with Barzal in New York, or in Long Island, on Long Island, I should say. Long Islanders hate when you say in Long Island. But, you know, a lot of the RFA signing short-term deals, Cirelli, you know, Sergachev even, like, I mean, you know, there's, you look at all the RFAs who have signed, and then you look at Kotkaniemi and Suzuki coming up, you know, yes, it's good to have them on the cheap for now, but I think it's reasonable to expect that they will have them on the relatively cheap for even longer than that. Like, their second contract is likely to be affordable, in the sense, like, Dubois is going to make $5 million a year for the next 2 years, or he's $5 million cap hit for the next 2 years.
Good value.
For a player of his caliber, that's a good contract. You know, that's a good, that's a good cap number. And so I think it's probably pretty likely that Kotkaniemi is going to sign a 2-year bridge deal, that Suzuki is going to sign a 2-year bridge deal, just because the cap's not going to move. Expenses are going to go up. You know, I mean, it's just like, it's, you know, when we spoke to Bergevin at the beginning of last season, you know, he had suggested that if all things being equal, he would prefer to sign Kotkaniemi to a long-term deal coming out of his entry level. I'm not sure if he were to ask that question today, I don't think he'd be on board, because you look at all the short-term bridge deals that RFAs have signed, high-impact RFAs, and again, assuming Kotkaniemi has the season that he's expected to have. You know, he's expected to take a significant step this season. If he takes that step and he gets to the end of the year and he's been a very productive player, very effective, and shown the level of potential that someone like Pierre-Luc Dubois has shown, getting him for 2 years at $5 million a year, that's conceivable, especially with some of the money that's expected to be kind of liquidated off of the cap or removed from the cap at the end of the season. And so, again, I think that makes your point that much more important, is that not only are we looking at a window of time for Kotkaniemi where his contract's up this season and Suzuki's is up next season, and Romanov's is up actually at that same time with Suzuki, because don't forget, he burned the first year of his entry level. So if these three guys are going to be as important to this team as the Canadians anticipate they will, there was a time not that long ago where I think, you know, we did the exercise where we were trying to figure out how much money these guys are going to make. Now, with the current landscape, I think they're going to remain affordable for longer than that, for an extra 2 years. So at that point, it makes even less sense to go after a guy who's probably a year away from his big contract, when you, in all likelihood, have, let's say at the end of this season, in all likelihood, you'll have 2 more years of Jesperi Kotkaniemi at a reasonable cap hit, and you'll have 3 years of Suzuki and 3 at that reasonable cap hit. And you have players who by then could conceivably come into the center role and fill that third line center position quite adequately or even well in Ryan Poehling and Jake Evans. Like, at a certain point, you know, that's going to be to me at least, that's likely to be their 4 centers within 2 years, is Suzuki, Kotkaniemi, Poehling and or Evans, and Poehling and or Evans. So it's really, yes, Dubois would be an upgrade, but financially, like, you don't want to bend over backwards just to get a guy because he's available. You know, I mean, it has to make sense. And so I think the assets required to get him, because even if Bergevin considered trading Kotkaniemi, he would have to put in more. He'd have to add like a second round pick or a prospect of some sort, you know, one. And it's not as if he doesn't have prospects. Like, let's make one thing clear. Bergevin has the assets to make a trade like that work, in the sense that he has 2 young centers. He has a ton of draft picks and he has a ton of prospects. You know, we mentioned Caulfield earlier, and Gouley and Struble and Harris and Norlander and all these guys. he has the attractive enough prospects to make a deal work. The one way I think that this does make sense for the Canadians is if they find a way to build a package around Phil Deneau, who is heading towards UFA, is obviously significantly older than Pierre-Luc Dubois. So from Jarmo Kekäläinen's perspective, I don't know if that makes a whole lot of sense, but if they can get Deneau signed and you add to that with, you know, a pretty good prospect, like at that point, Caulfield has to enter the conversation, right? Like if it, or, you know, you know, like you basically have to add Caulfield to that mix and add perhaps even a first round pick. But if you could turn Deneau into Dubois and then all of a sudden you have Suzuki, Kotkaniemi and Dubois, well, then now things are getting very interesting, right? Like that's something. But if I'm Jarmo Kekäläinen, I mean, there's going to be other suitors. Pierre LeBrun has a piece today with all the potential teams that are going to go after Dubois. And, you know, the first one he mentions is the Anaheim Ducks. And you look at a team like that with all the prospects that they have, all the pieces they could offer, plus the added benefit of being in the West under normal circumstances. And I'm sure Jarmo Kekäläinen would rather trade Dubois into the Western Conference. You look at the Kings, there's so many other possibilities from Kekalainen's perspective where if the Canadians aren't willing to include Suzuki or Kotkaniemi, they probably take themselves out of the conversation. I don't think a package built around Deneau is going to convince Kekalainen to pull the trigger on a trade like that.
No, probably not, because you've got also there are the Ducks. I think that the New York Rangers also will have all the assets required to, you know, to make a compelling offer.
Yeah.
If the Canadians could manage to build something around,
that's even harder because the Rangers are in their division. Like, that would be even harder. But anyhow, but you're right.
Yeah, yes. I know. But ultimately, I mean, if they're the ones coming up with the best offer, they're not going to say no.
No, I agree. Absolutely.
So, but if the Canadians can do something based around Deneau, and Deneau as you know can sign right away a new deal, because just, let's face it, I mean, he's on an expiring contract. The Blue Jackets would not acquire a player they're not sure to sign.
Absolutely.
You don't give up your best player for a guy who remains a question mark. But he would, you know, he would probably be signed for a number comparable to what Dubois signed right now. So money wise, at least for them, it would make sense. You mentioned Caulfield. I think that it's an interesting asset, first round pick, stuff like that. But yeah, it's if they want to get younger, if they want to make sure that they've got futures, that they've got guys that are surefire future stars, maybe they'll have to look elsewhere. But for the Canadians, my oh my, if you end up with a center line of Dubois, Suzuki, and Kotkaniemi, well, there's going to be one of those guys that as a third line center down the road who would be sort of wasted being so down the lineup. But all those guys would be under 25. That would make the Canadians so dangerous, and it's pretty tantalizing to think of that.
Yeah, it's just not realistic. I mean, I think the only way Pierre-Luc Dubois winds up in a Canadiens uniform is if one of Suzuki or Kotkaniemi is headed the other way, and I think as we've explained, it's highly debatable whether that makes a whole lot of sense for the Canadians for a whole bunch of reasons. I mean, even just like, you just look at size, okay? Like, I mean, I think Kotkaniemi weighed in at 201 pounds and he's listed at 6'2". Dubois is, as I mentioned, 6'3", around 220. Is it impossible to imagine 2 years from now, when he's 22 years old, that Kotkaniemi would be somewhere around 6'2", 220, 215, let's say. Like he's, you know, I mean, it's just... Yes, Kotkaniemi's entering his third season, but he's 20 years old. It's really a very, very important consideration to keep in mind when having a conversation like this. But that's not to say that he's untouchable, that you would never trade Kotkaniemi. That would be ridiculous. And Dubois is a guy where you should at least consider it. You definitely have to consider the pros and cons because Dubois is a hell of a player, has a lot of years ahead of him. And as I mentioned, checks all the boxes for the Canadians. But in my mind, the only way he winds up here is if Bergevin is willing to trade one of the two. And of the two, I think the one he'd be more willing to trade is probably Kotkaniemi at this point.
Yeah, and it goes back to my first point. I think that this upcoming season will say a lot about how the Canadians view Kotkaniemi and Suzuki, and if they consider them to become untouchable, or they could consider moving a guy like KK in a deal. So, yeah.
But one thing I do want to mention, and you brought it up briefly before, but it's important here, yeah, is that it's for the Canadians particularly. Once the season starts, you can forget this trade because there's no way, unless they do it around, there's a couple of like mini bye weeks in the Canadian schedule where they have like, you know, when they come back from their trip out west, this opening trip, they come back and they have 4 days off, and there's another week in February where they have a big chunk of time off. That might be a time when you could do an in-season trade like this, because there's no way the Canadians, with the condensed schedule and how tight the playoff race is going to be, there's no way the Canadians put themselves in a situation where they're trading, let's say, Kotkaniemi, and they get Dubois back, and they have to go a week without either Dubois or Kotkaniemi in their lineup. That's not happening. Like, that's so.
Well, it would have to happen, because if it's a trade between an American,
well, that's what I'm saying,
and a Canadian team, we're talking about a 14-day quarantine. That's not a 7-day quarantine.
I don't know if it would be 14 days. I think the NHL's, I think it would be, I'm not sure about that. We need to check.
Well, according to a report from the Canadian press this morning, that would be the case.
14 days. So that's what I'm saying, is that once the season begins, this trade is not happening. Like, it's not happening until the end of the season. And so,
right.
Whereas Columbus, if they wanted to, I think, well, the 14-day, that has to do with the border, right? I mean, we're not talking. So
No. It's not related to the NHL. It's related to
to government regulations.
To governmental regulations.
Right. So if the Ducks wanted to trade for him, for instance, they wouldn't be subject to the same amount of quarantine, I would think.
No.
So in any case, that's why, to me, well, first of all, I think trading period is going to be difficult during the season, but for that reason, you know, it's. I think we could stop talking about this as soon as the season begins, because it's not. There's no way the Canadians are going to go 2 weeks, let alone 1 week, but 2 weeks, without either Kotkaniemi and without Dubois theoretically in their lineup, and the amount of games they would have to play shorthanded makes this like basically a non-starter, because they have so much invested in this season. I don't think they're going to jeopardize anything for this season, because again, Bergevin's really got high hopes, and it's, you know, first time ever, I think, we've heard Bergevin prior to the season not put the season's goals as making the playoffs, and we'll see what happens. You know, this is
the expectations are much higher.
High expectations internally. We've never heard him say that, so no. There's no way he's going to put that in jeopardy to make a trade like this in season. So
yeah,
it's fun to talk about it now, but we'll talk about it again in the summer.
Yeah, that's it. Regarding trades, I wonder though, something came up in my mind. I wonder if there are guys that are forced to be on the sidelines for quarantine reasons during the time that they're not able to play, are their salaries going to be counted against the cap? They need to be replaced somehow. Otherwise, it's like it's dead money that's being spent on teams that are already short on players. So I don't know what's going to be the league's ruling on that front. If I guess we'll [S2] Right. [S1] See once the situation arises. But anyway, there's, as you could tell, everybody, there was plenty to talk about today. There'll be plenty of talk about next week, because by then, the season will have started. So
yes.
we're only 5 days away from puck drop. So it's pretty exciting. So thanks a lot, everybody, for listening. So as usual, don't forget to take a look at our articles on theathletic.com. Subscribe if you have not, and we'll be back next week for another edition of Le Super Athlétique, this time in French. So thank you, Arpin.
Thanks, Marc-Antoine. And just to mention, if you want to subscribe, go to theathletic.com/athletic support, and you will get a discount on your first year's subscription. And we will talk to you next week.
Awesome. Bye-bye, everybody.